Welcome to the market, sponsored by the CME Group. Hello, everyone. Orion Samuelson finally at home base back in the Midwest. A little bit later, Max Armstrong will be chiming in, and it's June Dairy Month, so he and his market guest will be talking about the dairy situation during a challenging time for some dairymen across the country. And a lot of other news to talk about as we ended this trading week on Wall Street today. Talk about something roiling the market. Major stock indices ended a little changed, even as Amazon.com's $13.7 billion deal to buy upscale grocer Whole Foods roiled the retail sector and rocked shares of an array of companies, including Walmart and Target. Walmart shares down 4.7%, weighing the most on the Dow. Shares of Target, Walgreens Boots, and Costco fell between 5 and 7%. One analyst said, "It's going to send a shockwave across the board, and this represents the true utmost in market disruption." The deal by Amazon, a proven retail disruptor, marked a major step by the internet retailer into the brick-and-mortar retail sector. Amazon shares gained 2.4%, making the stock the biggest boost to the S&P 500. Whole Foods shares went up 29%. Grocery chain Kroger was the biggest loser in the food marketing field on the S&P 500, down a little more than 9%, while Super Value dropped 14.4%. Another analyst said, "I would not like to be somebody playing in the grocery space right now." The technology sector down slightly as well, as Apple shares closed down 1.4%. Technology has led the S&P 500's 8.7% rally this year, but posted its second week of declines, prompting questions over whether investors are moving money into other sectors. And in a report today, U.S. home building fell for a third straight month in May to the lowest in 8 months as construction activity declined broadly. Investors were continuing to digest the Federal Reserve's interest rate hike on Wednesday, some concerned about the economy's ability to absorb higher rates. One other corporate news story, Booz Allen Hamilton shares dropped 19% after news that the investigation was underway by the U.S. Department of Justice. So when it was all said and done today for the week, the S&P up 0.05%, the Dow added 0.5%, the NASDAQ dropped nearly a point. And at the end of the trading session, the Dow Industrial Average up 24 points, ending the day and the week at 21,384. The S&P 500 gained just 0.2%, ending at 2433.15. And the NASDAQ composite dropped 13.75 points to 61.5176. So that was the day on Wall Street, centering on the food retailing business. And with the reputation of Amazon.com, I can understand why some of the other food entities are a little bit concerned about what could happen. My question is, will that mean that your butter and milk and bread and soup will be delivered by drone? I guess we'll wait to see. So let's look ahead to next week. U.S. banks and their investors hope to see evidence of easing regulatory pressure in their annual stress test score that will be released by the Federal Reserve on Thursday. The hypothetical scenarios for economic and market stress for this year's test were set in January. Results from the latest supervisory stress test conducted as part of the Dodd-Frank Act could show that after the November elections, regulators are more inclined to give banks the benefit of doubts about their underlying strength. Looking ahead to next week also, after the Federal Reserve hiked interest rates, several Fed presidents will make appearances across the country. Most of them will be on the road speaking at one meeting or another. Housing data next week could offer some fresh clues on the health of the housing market, which came in weak today with that report. But home building declined in May for a third straight month, and the National Association of Realtors is expected to report on Wednesday that existing home sales fell 0.7% in May. FedEx Corporation Tuesday will report, well, it's expected, the company will report an increase in its fourth quarter profit and revenue, boosted by higher sales at its express business. The package shopping giant is, or I should say shipping giant, is considered an economic bellwether, with shipping activity used as a proxy for overall economic activity. Oracle Corporation expected to report its fourth quarter results on Wednesday, and analysts say the business software maker is expected to post a decline in revenue. Oracle, which gets a little over half of its revenue from outside the United States, has been benefiting from its transition to cloud-based products from selling software licenses. Adobe Systems scheduled to report second quarter results after the markets close on Tuesday. The Photoshop maker expected to post a strong increase in quarterly revenue, helped by higher demand for its Creative Cloud package of software tools. Accenture expected to report an increase in revenue in the third quarter. It'll be reporting on Thursday. The consulting and outsourcing services provider is benefiting from its investment in digital and cloud services, which gives it a fair advantage over its peers such as Cognizant. BlackBerry Limited will release its quarterly results on Friday and will provide new clues on progress in its turnaround effort. Investors will really check the results for signs that the Canadian firm, best known for losing the smartphone wars to Apple, Samsung, and Google, is gaining traction in a years-long campaign to reinvent itself. And we'll get one other mark on the housing industry, too, because on Tuesday, Lennar Corporation, the number two U.S. home builder, expected to report an increase in revenue for the second quarter, helped by higher home sales, lower unemployment rate, and improving employment opportunities for young Americans. Seems to be underpinning demand for housing. So investors will look for comments on housing sales during the ongoing spring selling season and an update on full-year financial forecast. And there'll be reports from various agencies and companies north of the border in Canada and south of the border in Mexico that some people will be watching. But that's what's ahead for next week. On Wall Street, along with the ongoing political turmoil on Capitol Hill, who knows what kind of surprises will hit us next week. Could be another one as big as the Amazon.com Whole Foods situation that really caught the market apparently by surprise today. Well, June is Dairy Month, and so when we come back with Max Armstrong and his guests, Ryan Yonkman of Rice Dairy, we'll talk about the situation facing dairymen across the country in this celebration of June Dairy Month, when we continue on the market sponsored by the CME Group.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group, Advance with confidence.
It's the milk situation, the dairy farmer situation we talk about this weekend with Ryan Yonkman from Rice Dairy in Chicago. June Dairy Month, we always do a lot of promotion of milk. The dairy industry historically has promoted milk in the month of June. There is some economic rationale to that, is there not, if you take us back historically to talk about what we're doing in this industry?
Yeah. I mean, as we head into June, you're talking summer months, you're talking grilling season, ice cream season, demand really starts to perk up after coming out of flush months where we've, you know, put our highs in for milk production for the year. So it's a great time to see a lot of promotions going on to get this product moving out of the coolers and to the consumer.
For folks who aren't familiar with dairying, you use the term flush month. What does that mean?
You know, it's actually got a little less importance to it today than what it did back in the day, where it just means cows are coming into their peak. Today, with our ability to how we house the cows and the way we feed them, you don't actually see quite the extreme we used to see as far as milk production growing from, you know, the lows in the fall to where they are in the spring. But just means we're at our max of production when it comes to the cow itself.
Historically, that related to the greening of the pastures in the spring, did it not? And the ability to put those cows out on the pasture and enhance the production that way. And these days, there aren't nearly as many pasture-grazed cows.
Correct.
The big operations that we have control the feed. They control many things, and it's all related to the health of the cow. They have to keep that cow healthy, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, that is our profit center. So our investment is primarily put into keeping that cow healthy, getting as much production out of her as we can while still putting her in an environment where she's happy and comfortable and looking good in the public eye.
How do we keep the milk output climbing? How does that work? I mean, I've been watching these monthly totals month after month. It's not just a matter of adding cows to the herd in the United States. The producers continue to ratchet up month after month the output per cow. How are they doing it, Ryan?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a vicious cycle. You'd like to think we continue to add cows because the market's paying us to continue to add cows, but the reality of this is a lot of it has to do with us just becoming more efficient every year, finding better ways to feed the animals and increase output by doing that. Again, better facilities. With technology, we just continually are finding better ways to get more milk out of these animals without necessarily increasing costs. Another aspect of this is economies of scale. A lot of these smaller farms have now become big farms, and a lot of these big farms have become mega farms. And a lot of that has to do with just simply maxing out your facilities. On paper, it's going to show a higher return. And so we've seen a lot of that expansion happen over the last few years and still see it happening, having a lot of it little to do with world prices or what we're even getting paid here. Which is part of what we're seeing now, where we've got a ton of milk in what has been a declining price market up until maybe what we see coming around the corner here.
I'll talk a little more about that with you in just a moment. Use the term mega farms, mega producers. We were at the World Pork Expo a few days ago, and they listed all of the big pork producers in the world. I think there were 26 operations that have 100,000 sows or more each on that list. And yet, I think maybe in the minds of some consumers, mega, big, means bad. And that isn't necessarily the case, especially isn't the case when it comes to animal comfort and care.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think there's nothing wrong with large operations. I can make the case a lot of these larger operations are doing a better job, or at least as good a job, as someone who might be milking 200 or 300 cows. We're in a free market, and we've got the decision to be as big as we want to be. I think no issues there. The world is inevitably asking for this milk, and these types of dairies are making the decision to provide it.
What's interesting in the summertime is to go in one of the big barns of a larger dairy operation, and one operator in southern Indiana pointed out to me that his employees, in the heat of the day, go into the cow barn because that's where the comfort is. So whether they're using misters or he's got the big fans moving the air through there, his employees feel so comfortable there, and so do the cows.
Yeah, back to where technology has gone and infrastructure, these cows are comfortable. 100-degree heat doesn't do what it did to cows a few years ago. We're able, and part of why we talked about the flush months kind of not being as big as it used to be, we've got these cows in these controlled environments that allows production to be steady and steadily increase as we can, you know, put different types of feed and find ways to keep them even more comfortable.
Well, we have to look at our situation in light of what's happening around the globe these days, because the dairy market is very much of a global market. Is the output continuing to climb elsewhere in the big dairy-producing regions of Europe and New Zealand, other parts of the world?
Well, it hasn't, dating back to last year. We actually saw European milk production decline anywhere from 2 to 3%. We saw New Zealand down a little bit. You know, all of those areas are now out of their flush months. New Zealand will be gearing up to come into their flush this fall. But as of right now, we've seen the peaks for milk production globally. And with places like Europe and New Zealand down, that's led to some of the tightness we've seen internationally, which I think is a big part of why we're seeing European and New Zealand prices rally currently, actually making the United States the cheapest dairy products in the world. This is a big thing we're looking at right now that leads me to believe these summer months could lead to considerably higher prices for the U.S. if that relationship can hold. It'll make the U.S. A great export partner for a lot of these countries that can actually come to the States and buy dairy products cheaper than they can there.
The bad news is, at least at the moment, milk is cheap, as you pointed out. And for the producer, that means a small milk check.
Yeah, so around the corner, things look positive. But as of today, just looking at a most recent milk check for May that we received, you're still seeing a lot of high 13, low 14, depending on where you are, milk checks. That does not cash flow. If these prices were to stay here for a reason the U.S. was not to take off, I can make the case that a few months down the road, you could see some dairies go out of business. You could see some liquidation. It's not been a great couple years by any means. Again, the curve looks optimistic, but with what I see today, dairies are struggling. And we need to see a rally. What we get, we'll see going forward.
So $13, $14, $100, that's below break even. What would break even be? I know that's highly variable. You got to look one operation to another, and it would vary by region, I would imagine. But what's a good number for the Midwest, for the Wisconsin producer, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan?
So maybe a fair number would be somewhere around $16, and the milk check, I think, can cover for a lot of dairies. In a state like Michigan and Wisconsin, it's actually two completely different stories, even though we consider ourselves to be in the Midwest. Michigan has got a serious lack of processing. We've been dumping milk. We've been moving milk all over the country, which has created a huge negative basis. So for those who like to reference Class 3, we've been anywhere from $1 to $2 under that market. Whereas if I walk into the state of Wisconsin, they could still be anywhere from $1 to $2 over. So profitability actually swings massively just from state to state. So in a state like Michigan, you know, you're looking at $15.50, we're not getting it. In a state like Wisconsin, they should be still getting that and doing okay. So the economics change, I think, massively from state to state. A lot of it having to do with is their processing and how far does this milk have to move to go find a home. States like Michigan, it's a problem. In New York, it's a problem. Not the case for Wisconsin, which has more cheese processing facilities than any other state in the country.
We saw the President of the United States even get involved in a cross-border dairy dispute, the United States and Canada, with this filtered milk. Is that what is at the heart of the situation there, that we feel the Canadians are unfairly keeping U.S. product out?
That was definitely the issue. I'm not going to take a side on what was right or wrong, but the reality is it did stop some U.S., you know, UHT milk from moving into Canada. But on the flip side, if I look at exports going into Canada, it is actually up almost double for butter, a market that we're seeing very tight. So, and even with the talks into Mexico, we've watched exports increase the last few months in pretty big numbers, 30, 20% on non-fat cheese. So we are still moving a lot of product into our neighboring countries. It's just having some issues with this certain type of milk for the time being.
So despite all of this talk about NAFTA and renegotiating NAFTA and all of the angst about NAFTA, as far as the dairy situation is concerned, if you look at the picture as a whole, we're still doing very well. The United States is growing its market with the two big partners north and south of us.
It sure looks like it. Again, just looking at the numbers, seeing exports of butter up almost twofold year over year going into Canada, watching exports into Mexico up big on cheese, up big on nonfat. We're still finding ways to get it out of the country. And again, with the U.S. being cheapest in the world, we should be. So it's a positive to see those things happening.
You seem to be a little bit optimistic that these low prices are going to improve. What's the time frame you're thinking about and what has to fall into place? Does China have to come back into the market in a big way?
China's been here. I think we just need to continue to do what we are, which we need to see exports continue to go out the door. It's, you know, in years past, it's we tend to converge toward where world prices are. This is a good time to see it, right? We're walking into June, July. This heat can back milk production off a little bit. Demand goes toward its highs. I think anywhere between now and the next 60 to 90 days, if I had to throw a dart at it, I'd say we've got a good chance to see U.S. prices converge toward world, which could mean maybe we see milk checks bump $1 to $2 a hundredweight. That said, that's not something I'm willing to get married to and hitch my wagon and say we're good to go in the long haul. There are some things around the corner that make me nervous, like Europe's ability to turn milk back on. Big part of their milk production decline had a lot to do with subsidies. Government kind of came in and said, hey, we'll pay you X to make less. Well, those have run up and their milk prices rallied during that. So now you're back on the market. You're profitable. I'm not ruling out the fact that EU could come on in a big way. And maybe by the time we get to the end of the year, this idea of lower milk production around the world has changed.
And I'm doing the math in my head here as you're talking, Ryan. I'm adding $1 to $2 a hundredweight to that $13 to $14 price. This business still, at that price level, is not ragingly profitable.
Not for states like Michigan or New York. And again, you walk into Wisconsin, maybe some other places, it could be fantastic. So, you know, in a state like Michigan where we have overproduced in a big way, maybe that's something we need to see. And you see some declines in milk production. Maybe you see some cows leave the state, some farms leave the state. But you're 100% right. A good rally could, in some places, just get us back to break even or cash flowing a small margin again.
Are you aware of any efforts to bring in additional processing capacity into Michigan, for example, to try to approach it from a different angle rather than downsizing the herd, increasing the nearby demand?
Yeah, so there is talk of a pretty good-sized cheese plant coming into the state of Michigan, taking around, I think, 8 million pounds a month. Problem with that, or it takes a couple years to get a cheese plant built and running. So there has been talk of that coming our way, which would be great. I think when people run the math, by the time that plant's up and running, you can make the case we need three of them if things continue the way they are. So yes, processors tend to find a way, I think, toward cheap milk. I mean, that's their input. Michigan's creating that. So I'd like to think you'll see some of that stuff happen. But until ground is broke and we see that going up right now, it's still just very much a conversation.
In my own way, I'll do my own part during June Dairy Month. Make mine milk, Max would say, and I'll wait into July with great pride because that's ice cream month. Ryan Yockman, thank you.
Thank you.
He's with Rice Dairy.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
The world of agriculture this week hit by several different items. In the livestock trade at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, we ended the week with cattle and hog futures mostly higher, and most of that because of short covering. Prices stabilized after Thursday's multi-week lows and hogs consolidating in the middle of their recent trading ranges. So when we start trade Monday, the July lean hog contract will start at $82.32, the August lean hog contract at $79.12. Now, part of the problem with the cattle industry this week is cash cattle prices have declined for several weeks, even as rising wholesale beef prices boosted profits for meat packers. Department of Agriculture, after the close of trading today, said choice grade beef was up 10 cents for the day to $249.84. Pork in the wholesale market gained 73 cents to $95.63 per hundredweight. And we look at the closing cattle market. August live cattle will start the week Monday at $118.17 a hundredweight. August feeder cattle will start at $1.12, the higher at $147.87 a hundredweight. Moving on to the grain market. Well, there we saw once again weather being a factor in the market, but it certainly gave a boost to wheat. Wheat rallied to its highest level since June a year ago. And for the day, corn and soybeans closed firm. The wheat market rallied 2.6% to their highest in nearly a year. Still concerns about shortfalls in the U.S. crop, sparking a round of short covering by investment funds. But interesting to see this market action in light of the fact that the world still has more than enough wheat in storage. But any kind of a weather scare will make its way into the marketplace. Corn futures also ended the day higher, but forecasts for rain in key growing areas of the Midwest limited buying. Soybean futures firmed as well, supported by technical buying and signs of strong demand. There are reports of some disappointing yields in early harvest of the Plains hard red winter wheat belt, and that helped keep the market a little bit stronger. Well, let me talk now about President Trump's announcement today on Cuba and pulling back on some of the trade and visitor openings that happened during the Obama administration. The announcement brought immediate response from various farm groups. Let me quote some of them. First of all, from the National Corn Growers Association, Texas farmer Wesley Spurlock, who is president of the association, said this: Cuba should be an easy market for U.S. corn farmers. Instead, that market has gone to our competitors, costing us an estimated $125 million in lost opportunity each year. If trade with Cuba were normalized, it would represent our 11th largest market for corn. Instead, we have just 11% market share in a country only 90 miles from our border. At a time when the farm economy is struggling, we ask our leaders in Washington not to close doors on market opportunities for American agriculture. That's reaction from the Corn Growers Association. From the U.S. Grains Council, the council has worked in Cuba for nearly two decades to help capture grain demand and develop its livestock industry within the confines of U.S. policy. And while the announcement today will make our efforts in Cuba more difficult and almost certainly cost U.S. corn farmers sales in the short term, we have every intention of continuing our work there to build long-term mutually beneficial trade. Then we heard from the president of the Illinois Farm Bureau, Rich Giebert. And he said, Illinois Farm Bureau policy suggests aggressive actions to expand market share for Illinois and U.S. agricultural exports to Cuba. We supported the previous administration's efforts to expand travel and normalize the U.S.-Cuba relations, and we view this announcement as a temporary step backwards. The Cuban people benefit by having more, not fewer, contacts with Americans. And at the end of the day, Cuba should be buying Illinois soybeans and corn, not products from South America. So that's the reaction from the farming community. It'll be interesting to see how Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue deals with it. Oh, by the way, Sonny will be traveling, or I should say the secretary, will be traveling to Savannah, Georgia on Monday, June 19th. He's going there for a meeting called Partners for Agriculture in North America. And he'll be meeting with Canadian Agriculture Minister Lawrence McAuley and Mexican Secretary of Agriculture Jose Calzada Ruvarosa. And it's a trilateral meeting, and they'll be discussing trade and some of the trade difficulties and challenges and opportunities. Could be an interesting meeting to watch. Well, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us. Max Armstrong, I'm Orion Samuelson on The Market, sponsored by the CME Group.